That's The Fix from 1983. One thing leads to another, looking kind of at the big picture, which is what we're doing tonight, looking at connections between interconnected power centers that make up a larger deep state apparatus. Mark Gorton is our guest, and in this segment, I will get to some calls in a bit, but I want to cover some other ground about different presidents and where they have stood and how they interacted with the deep state apparatus. Maybe some of the terrorist incidents that have received so much attention in recent years. We'll be right back to cover a lot of ground with Mark Gorton here on Coast to Coast AM. Mark, I'd like to ask a little bit about pushback, if there's been any for you. When you first wrote these essays a couple of years ago and then sent them out to some of your employees and family members, people close to you, did you pretty much assume that it was going to leak out and you'd have to answer questions about it at some point?
Oh, it never occurred to me that that would happen.
No kidding. I mean, as meaty as the essays were, that they wouldn't see the light of day, because did you ask for confidentiality of the people that received it?
No, I mean, so I sent it mostly to family and friends, and a couple of my, you know, friends are people I work with. And I said, you know, you could pass this around. So, I mean, I figured, you know, maybe a couple hundred people would read these essays. I mean, it never occurred to me that they would go viral and then somehow end up on Gawker.
And was there pushback for you? I mean, as I said at the beginning of the program, you hesitated when you got that first call asking you to comment and did you really write this? But no one, as far as I know, and no one has fired a 50 caliber sniper rifle round through your window. But have there been consequences for you on Wall Street? And how is it viewed among your colleagues there, your competitors?
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I will say that I was already kind of out at work. You know, if, you know, it's not that people didn't know, you know, the people that I eat lunch with regularly, you know, when we talk about current events, it's not like I didn't give my perspective on things. And so I think, you know, maybe it was less of a shock to people close to me. One of the things that's very interesting is just that people are very tolerant. You know, it's you know, kind of everyone can have their own political beliefs, and you know, it doesn't really impact my day-to-day life or work very, you know, at all, hardly.
It seems like so much of what goes on now is seen through a partisan prism. Everything is, and you know, the country is clearly pretty divided along partisan lines. Any issue that's raised anywhere, it's hard to have a conversation with. I don't know what it's like in your family, but in families across the country, tempers flare, and it's almost to the point where people can't talk to each other about this thing because partisan fervor is so great. You go down a list in your essays. You go down a list of all of our recent presidents, and sort of spell it out. And I wonder if there are any partisan concerns that you are making a point to be even-handed in your indictment of both parties and their involvement, or that's just where the facts led you?
Yeah, I mean, that's just where the facts are. I mean, I think one of the things that's very important to understand is that the deep state really transcends political parties, and it's not in one party or another party, but that these forces that are more profound than either political party that are constantly looking to influence both political parties.
Do you think it serves the purpose of the deep state to have us at each other's throats, to have a divide?
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I mean, the strategy of tension is one of, you know, it's a classic political control strategy that's existed since, you know, as long as there have been governments, and it's actively being used. And I think it's one of the most important things for people to understand that, you know, this is an active, ongoing strategy. And every time they hear about whether it's terrorist attacks or crime or the Russian threat or whatever it is, something that's trying to scare you to get behind the powers that be, so that you're not asking, you know, okay, you know, well, what's really going on here? And maybe the big issues we should be examining are internal. I mean, this is, and the fact is, the strategy of tension works incredibly well. I mean, you can see today just how very effective it is.
Yeah, we choose up sides, and then our side is always right, and the other side is always wrong, and we don't want to hear any information contrary to the opinion we already have. And that costs us in so many ways. I mean, do you also think it is a goal of the deep state to take that tension a little bit further and to generate and instigate wars and conflicts, bombs, missiles?
I mean, you know, absolutely. I mean, the United States is an empire, and there's just huge money in being an empire. I mean, if you look at the cumulative sum of all the military spending, you know, the money we get from, you know, the global, whether it's the oil business or, you know, the fruit business in Central America. I mean, all of these industries around the world. I mean, it's staggering the amount of money that there is in this. And so, you know, maintaining the United States as an aggressive empire is very, very important for a lot of very, very wealthy, powerful interests. And I mean, and there's no doubt about it. I think the primary reason for the Vietnam War, absolutely just basically money and power. Same thing for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, if you go and study the real causes behind it, I mean, anytime you see the, you know, the United States claiming that there's some atrocity around the world that we have to intervene for some reason, I think you have to be asking yourself, okay, you know, who's going to profit from this, and what are the real deeper motives there? Because there's all sorts of atrocities that we ignore all the time. So that can't be the simple explanation there.
Let me go down a list of presidents, and you can give me sort of the thumbnail sketch about their level of cooperation or lack thereof with the deep state. We mentioned about JFK already. What about Nixon?
Nixon's fascinating because, I mean, he's a very smart guy, a real political operator who at times allies himself with, you know, he's, you know, this kind of militant anti-commie, you know, pro-McCarthy type guy at certain points in time. And he clearly knows what's going on in terms of, you know, roughly who killed Kennedy and, you know, what the scope of the forces are. But he kind of allies himself with these interests to become president. But then the interesting thing about Nixon is that when he becomes president, you get to see kind of who the real Nixon was to some extent. He starts becoming independent. And it's particularly second term Nixon is really quite independent. He's determined to reform the CIA. Now, the CIA knows this because the White House is being bugged and they're aware of his plans. And the deep state then, who put him in power to some extent, takes him down, because Watergate is a silent coup against Nixon. It's not the traditional story. Nixon was not behind the burglaries at the Watergate Hotel. He's not behind the cover up, and it's really just a CIA deep state coup to take down Nixon because he's becoming too independent.
Yeah, Nixon, the ultimate cold warrior, goes to China and then starts talking about taking apart the CIA. So I guess he had to go. That's amazing. And then Ford, of course, Warren Commission veteran.
Yeah, I mean, so that basically, I mean, it goes to show you, you know, the secret to becoming president is covering up another presidential assassination. I mean, he's kind of a junior member of the deep state. I mean, even though he becomes president and he has a relatively brief presidency, one of the things that I've been doing research on a topic that's very little known, but I've come to believe that the assassination attempts against Ford were actually part of deep state operations to put Nelson Rockefeller in the White House, but that I think they were sort of half-hearted attempts because there was a lot of powerful people in deep state who thought Rockefeller was too independent, so they didn't actually try too hard to kill Ford. But I think there are whole strands of things there.
Well, at a minimum, they sent a message, I guess.
Yeah.
And then Carter. Carter is sort of stands out as an exception in your laundry list.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really fascinating. You look at Carter, I mean, he actually comes up as an honest guy, fighting against election corruption in Georgia. I mean, it's also interesting that he's backed by the Rockefellers. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission. You know, so some people would say, oh, he's a, you know, member of the deep state. You know, everything, everybody is complicated. Everything is fluid and dynamic. But I mean, he really, I think, is a, you know, the most honest president that you know, in recent years. And I mean, you see that there's a lot of deep state pushback against Carter. I mean, the oil interests create an oil shortage to make it, you know, to kind of put the country in recession so he doesn't get reelected. They sabotage his attempt to free the hostages from Iran. And actually cut a deal with the Iranians so that the hostages are not released until after Carter is out of office. So, I mean, he is, you know, he's on the enemy list of the deep state by the end of his term in office.
Reagan.
I mean, Reagan is mostly, I view as kind of like a puppet character. And I mean, it's also, I mean, Reagan takes power. You have George H.W. Bush as the vice president. And the assassination attempt against him just after he becomes president was an attempt by George H.W. Bush to assume the presidency. And so, but, you know, Reagan is old. He, you know, he doesn't have the level of focus necessary to really keep things in check internally. And George H.W. Bush in the vice presidency is able to run a lot of independent operations all during the Reagan administration. And Reagan's also, you know, he's militantly anti-commie. So, you know, he's you know, kind of fine philosophically with a lot of the deep state interests.
So he's malleable in a sense. And then the Bush family and the Clinton families come along, and you're pretty rough on both of them.
Well, particularly George H.W. Bush. I mean, I think probably one of the most important things I learned over my research is just how absolutely pivotal George H.W. Bush is as a figure in the last 50, 60 years. I mean, he is, I think, the most important figure in American politics over that time period. I mean, he is a senior planner in the Kennedy assassination. I mean, he is, you know, born and bred into the CIA. He's the crown prince of the CIA. He is one of the absolute senior pivotal figures in Watergate in terms of deposing Nixon. I mean, he is behind everything, you know, whether it's CIA drug trafficking, Iran-Contra attempting to kill Reagan. And then, you know, later as you come forward, I mean, I personally view him, and I'm not sure that you know, a lot of, you know, what sort of agreement there is behind 9/11 researchers on this, but I view him as being the mastermind and the godfather of the 9/11 false flag attack.
And do you think George W. Bush knew about it ahead of time, or they just planned it underneath his notice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I find it interesting that people think that he was, you know, that he, you know, wouldn't know anything. And again, I don't think that he is the mastermind of it, but I mean, he's absolutely part of the operation. I mean, he's the heir of the Bush family. You know, the Bush family is deep in all of this, and you know, he's not some patsy that's just put up there. I mean, you look at the rest of what he's did. I mean, you know, he was, you know, basically completely transparent in that he starts a false war in Iraq. I mean, I think, you know, there's no reason to think that this guy was not particularly involved. And they also, they can't have the president of the United States, you know, accidentally being honest. I mean, you couldn't pull off that operation with a president who you weren't sure was down with it.
The Clintons, you say, I mean, it's no coincidence that there are so many murders in their proximity.
Yeah, I mean, so again, Bill Clinton is a fascinating character because, you know, he's clearly, you know, brilliant and charismatic. and rises up through the Arkansas political system. I mean, through, he's has political alliances with local drug traffickers. He is, particularly early Bill Clinton as governor, is just partying his brains out, using coke all the time. I mean, that's his social circle. But it's also the most important thing to understand is that while Bill Clinton's governor of Arkansas, MENA, Arkansas is the main transshipment point for drugs coming into the United States from Central America. And this drug trafficking operation is protected by Bill Clinton at the state level, and the state troopers are used to kind of allow the drug flights to come in. But that on a national level, it's George H.W. Bush who is running the drug trafficking, the CIA drug trafficking. And it's that alliance there, and that basically Bill Clinton is able to latch onto that power alliance there. And he actually gets a hand up to the national level. I mean, if you think about it, governor of Arkansas is not the natural stepping stone to political prominence. And one of the ways Bill Clinton steps up is through actually the help of the Bush family and their power network. And this is actually a great example of the deep state operating through both parties, that you have, members of the Republican Party influencing who takes control of the Democratic Party. And the fact that they're networks, that, some of it is the Skull and Bone Network and, the Harrimans and Pamela Harriman, who's so important for Bill Clinton taking prominence, that these networks transcend both parties, and that, some people are able to access power in both parties through these networks.
And the illicit drug trade has helped the deep state and different actors in that circle in so many different ways for decades, financing black projects. We have skullduggery in Central America and Panama. The CIA in the Vietnam era smuggling drugs. I sometimes wonder if that's why we're still in Afghanistan to control the poppy fields, but a lot of bad stuff has happened as a result of the illicit drug trade and presidential and government involvement in it.
Oh, right? Absolutely. And I really think that, in terms of, things that we can do to push back against the deep state is drug legalization, I think, is very important, because it cuts off of one of the primary sources of funding for these black ops, as you said. And I think that that's a very positive trend. And just as America got rid of prohibition because the fact that alcohol was leading to organized criminal influence in politics, I mean, you had the exact same thing with drug trafficking. And if we were to legalize drugs, that would weaken the criminal hold on our political structure.
You have written some pretty tough, harsh stuff about Obama as well. I haven't seen anything about Trump yet, but I know that some of the callers who've been holding for a while want to ask about that. We're talking with Mark Gorton about the deep state. When we come back, we're going to get to a few of your calls, so stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Led Zeppelin takes us into the break. From 1964, The Beatles, Things We Said Today. We're talking with Mark Gorton about the deep state. And of course, those events from the 60s, that string of assassinations, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, other shooting incidents sort of gutted our country, took the heart out of us, cut it out. And we're a different place as a result. Even this many years later, the effects are still being felt. Mark Gorton has called it a coup d'etat, as others have. In a moment, we'll go to the phones. We'll get some final thoughts from our guest, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can. Stick around here on Coast to Coast AM. The phone lines are pretty much full, and we'll get to your calls in just a second. I've got to ask one other question before we get too deep into the weeds. It's the UFO question, Mark. And I don't know. I've read several hundred books on UFOs, and a lot of the information is pretty crazy. But in some ways, the people involved, the agencies involved, are the same. It crosses a lot of the same turf. And I wonder, is that a topic that's just it's a bridge too far for you, that it seems too off track, or have you looked into that at all?
I mean, I've done almost no research on this topic at all. I did come across it once, and I will say that the one thing I you know, again, I used to think that it was just sort of completely wacky. I now think that at certain points of time, there were plans being concocted with inside the government for, you know, almost these, you know, false flag alien attacks. And it, you look, I mean, there, it's interesting. I mean, you even see comments from people like General MacArthur saying, you know, the next threat is going to come from outer space and things like that. And you do have a you know, a bunch of these kind of weird intelligence connections to UFO sightings and things like that that are, that just kind of make you scratch your head. My feeling is that, you know, that there were plans that were being considered and then, you know, never put into operation. But I really have spent almost no time researching this topic, and I really don't have very much to add on it.
I'll send you some stuff. And I think you'll recognize a lot of the same names, same actors involved. We'll go to the phones and see what's on the minds of our listeners tonight. East of the Rockies, Michael in Virginia Beach. Hi, Michael. You're on with Mark Gorton.
Thank you both. I think it was 2005 when Art Bell was just doing the show on weekends. And he did something that he had never done before in broadcasting, he said. He granted my request that he have a guest follow on the very next show that he did.
Michael, I'm going to ask you to get to it.
Okay.
Get to your question.
Okay, well, that's my request. I hope you'll have tonight's guest back again. And here is the issue. The issue is the deep state rivalries. Kennedys belong to a deep state group. There were four main deep state groups which had rivalries. One is the Freemasons. Another were the Jesuit-controlled deep staters. A third one were the fractional bankers. And a fourth one was a synthesis of the three, which felt that they had the best chance of setting up a new world order. The Jesuits were founded in 1542 by Ignatius in reaction to Luther's rebellion against.
Hey, Michael, I'm gonna ask you. We're gonna have to try to focus here because the phones are full. So, are you asking Mark to comment whether he has seen evidence of secret societies or rivalries within the deep state of different factions?
What I'm asking is that you go into depth on these rivalries.
So okay, I'm going to ask him that. Thank you for the call. I'm going to ask Mark that. Mark, have you seen any evidence of secret societies or rivalries of different factions within the deep state, as the caller was referencing?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you clearly have this. I mean, the deep state is made up of, you know, a constantly shifting series of alliances and factions, and it's, you know, I don't think you can even clearly name them or list them. It's changing all the time, and secret societies are clearly networks of people. Sometimes they're very powerful. They're clearly influential at various pieces in time, and they're the mechanism through which certain aspects of some of these black operations are carried out.
Michael, appreciate the call. We're going to go to a first-time caller, Kent in Salt Lake City. Hi, Kent. Hi, Kent. What's on your mind?
So the main question I have is if you've got close enough to any of these individuals to know their motivation. And the reason why I ask that question is because I see them as a bit of an obstacle for freedom to overcome. So in order to overcome it, we have to understand it.
Okay. Good question. What Mark, do you know what motivates him? Is it just money, selling arms and things of that sort?
I mean, I think, again, one of the, you know, interesting things you see as you study this is that, you know, all of this is a study of people in some ways, and the people are complicated and have a lot of different motivations. So, I mean, you know, one of the main motivations you see is, you know, greed, money, power, You know, certainly some major motivations are the need to protect yourself and cover up crimes and things like that. But also, you know, all of these people, no one is evil, no one is good, everyone is complicated. And so you have, you know, again, talk about LBJ, he's a very complicated character, you know, he clearly craves money and power. But he also has this desire to use that power for good, too. And you look at the, you know, the civil rights and a lot of the social legislation that he passed, you know, it's not easy to say with anyone. And I think that's also part of what can give us hope, is because even, you know, just because someone is allied with the deep state and deep in the deep state doesn't mean that they can't do good things and can't reform the system. I mean, it's you know, very complicated, and it's hard to really know what motivates people.
You look at the apparatus that you have described in your essays and that other people have written about in those 180 books or whatever that you've written, and it looks daunting, a daunting task. Are you optimistic? You had mentioned earlier one tactic that might work is the legalization of drugs. It takes away a funding source. Are there other things that you would recommend to our listeners that we could or should be doing?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I think I've really gotten, and one reason that I think people need to study the details of the mechanics of the deep state, is that it allows you to see what tools they use to operate and to take power. And so once you see how they operate, you can systematically take away those tools one by one, not that it's a trivial task. So I think election rigging is one of the key tools and one of the key crimes that is committed by the deep state. And so I think it's well worth everyone's time to put a lot of effort into cleaning up our election system, to getting, you know, good auditable elections, you know, having paper ballots, good audit processes. I mean, you know, good mechanisms to ensure that the voter rolls are not messed with. I mean, there's a ton of manipulation of the election system, gerrymandering, all of those things. And, you know, it's not easy to reform it, but with a large amount of effort, I think that is an area, because people in this country are not very tolerant of election rigging. And if you can, you know, bring that to people's attention, I think we can get reform on that front. I think transparency is just an absolute key principle to keep in mind. And I mean, another thing, you look at the FBI. FBI is done a lot of bad things over time. And partially it's able to do that because of secrecy. Like, I'll give you one particular example. The FBI has a policy of not allowing its agents to videotape interviews with suspects, which is, you know, sort of a little crazy. But again, just insisting that they actually videotape their interviews, and that these videotapes be kept, and that the FBI more, you know, have systems that track the evidence that they get, because the FBI constantly or frequently throughout the past is destroys evidence, covers up crimes. So if you just have a certain amount of transparency in that sense, you could make a difference. But again, getting the FBI to change their practices is not going to be easy. But if you had, you know, a few hundred people around the country who were really focused on that reform effort, you could make a real difference.
Just seems like, you know, if it's your party and your folks who are in power, there's less impetus from your group to want to change things. Gerrymandering, for example, you know, go ahead.
I don't think you're ever going to see the impetus from reform coming from the people in power. It's really got to be the citizen. I mean, all of these things, you know, the deep state forces are very happy to ally themselves with whoever's in power and form a, you know, this mutual interest. It's really insiders versus outsiders to a large extent.
We'll go to Bill, who's a trucker in Texas on the wild card line. Hi, Bill. You're on with Mark Gorton.
Yeah, hey, I had a comment and a question. My comment is on the epithet conspiracy nut. In order to influence someone on a personal cognitive level, you got to first discredit them. And that's why I think they use the epithet conspiracy nut. Basically, to counteract that, you have to embrace it. And then my question is on Trump's selection, cabinet selections. He has three general officers, one of which, General Mattis, they had to go through the facade of changing the law to even get General Mattis in there as the Secretary of Defense. I was wondering if you have any any comments on that.
I'm actually not particularly familiar with the details of that, so I don't really know.
I noticed that in your writing, your essays, at least at the time they came out, you had written about Obama and that he was basically a tool of the deep state. Nothing so far written about Trump. Are you going to write about Trump? And where do you see him on the spectrum?
Here, let me just comment on Obama for 1 second, which is to say he's a tool of the deep state, I think, is a little simplistic. I think he was clearly has very powerful forces, which he has never acknowledged, who helped him rise to power. You know, how much these forces dictated his policy once he became president is hard to say. He may have just been a person who is sort of temperamentally and philosophically aligned with these guys. I also think there's a reasonable chance that he was sexually compromised too, and that also may have been a mechanism to temper his policies. I've actually not been doing so much research on these topics recently. I mean, I got to a point where I, had covered 50 years or more of territory. And I think a reasonable idea of what happened in the last 50 years, and additional research doesn't yield me as much anymore. I pay very casual attention to Trump just because, you know, it's kind of hard to avoid that. I mean, one thing I found is that it's actually useful to, you know, just kind of wait. And, you know, observing current events is, you know, it takes a lot of time. If you wait, the noise kind of settles down and you can learn a lot more in shorter periods of time. I don't really have plans to write anything. I mean, if you want, I can give you my quick take on Trump, which is, I mean, I think in some ways he's an outsider. I don't think there was any plan from, you know, central deep forces that he becomes president. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of inside players in D.C. who, you know, him becoming president upset their plans. I mean, and so, but then at the same time, I think he's also, you can also view him as a product of the system and a product of this strategy of tension, which allows people like him to take office. So to some extent, these deep state actors are able to put in place these large-scale themes, fear of terrorism, you know, fear of the, you know, the outside, and then, you know, certain political actors are able to capitalize on these themes. But then if they're riding to power based on these themes, it almost doesn't matter to some extent who they are, because they're just accepting this antagonistic worldview.
We're going to go to wildcard 3 line. I believe it's Kent. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind?
I was going to ask you... the Vault 7 thing with WikiLeaks, is there a possibility, and I heard this floated around, that maybe that was an attempt on the deep state to release partial real and disinformation at the same time? And with regards to what you were just saying and the earlier caller, how much discretion or choice does the president really have, regardless of how he got to power?
I do think, I'm not familiar with the details of that particular leak of information, but I do think that, you know, the deep state leaks information as part of, you know, the it's one of the tools in their toolkit, and you always have to be questioning whether any leaked information, what is it true, or even if it is true, you know, what are the motivations behind it? And so, you know, I'm sure WikiLeaks is used by honest people who are looking to reform the system, and it's used by corrupt people who are looking to gain some edge somewhere. And certainly, I mean, I do think that, you know, anyone at the heart of the DC power structure, you know, is certainly constrained by the power of these deep state forces. And you see that, you know, people like Kennedy or Martin Luther King or either of the Kennedys who really refuse to be constrained. I mean, they're such a profound threat to the system. And I mean, it's sort of sad to say, but that I think you have a very hard time being a good president in the current context of the system without putting your life at risk. If you're going to be really honest and do your job, you're going to threaten so many powerful interests who have access to the ability to kill that, the fact is most people are not willing to risk their life. And so you really do get this very tepid, watered down leadership just as a matter of course.
You know, I had said earlier during one of the segues that those assassinations, JFK, RFK, MLK, that it sort of cut the heart out of our country, changed us as a people. Is that an overstatement?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of an overstatement. It certainly influenced the political course of the nation. I mean, if you think, you know, what would it have been like to have, you know, a Bobby Kennedy presidency, you know, or, you know, Martin Luther King continuing to be politically active for decades, you know, someone with, you know, his level of integrity and you know, motivation. I mean, it really, you know, a lot of the changes in the that we saw in this country, you know, we would have been on a different political course. Did it cut the heart out of a country? I mean, I think that, you know, that maybe it gutted the political system for a short period of time, but you know, the American people in America is really just so strong, and that we're very resilient. And that, you know, it's important to keep all of this stuff in context, because as you know, much as we've been talking about a series of really negative things here, I think if you look at America in the context of, you know, how corrupt is it compared to countries throughout history, we're still on the, you know, way better than average side. And there's a lot of social progress that's happening even amidst, you know, with all of the wars and corruption and things like that. And so it is important to keep a balanced point of view and to see the good as much as the bad, and to really study, you know, how you can make a positive impact, because it's easy to get depressed just looking at these things. But if you look at the countless, you know, acts by American citizens to just make our system better, I mean, there's so much hope in what people are doing too.
All right. Mark Gordon, I really appreciate you being here. I'm going to send you some info. So if you ever have free time again in your life, some things you can read, and if you're ever interested in coming back, we'd love to have you again. Thanks very much for being here.
Okay. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right. Robbie Williams takes us on the road to Mandalay into the break. In a moment, the secret life of mob boss Ralph Natale, the last Don standing. We'll be right back.